Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Now, I never realized, but there is a Stonehenge USA.
Yeah, I didn't until I realized who we were interviewing, and I had a look, and I was amazed. Fantastic.
So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about that. We're going to find out what it is, where it is, and what happens there. And so joining us today is Dennis Stone. How are you doing, Dennis?
Well, I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on today.
So, Dennis Stone, did you change your last name to work the Stonehead?
we get that question asked all the time, but that's always been our name. So I guess it's kind of preordained or something, you know, but that's our name.
You could always just add it to your name.
But it's appropriate.
Yeah, that'd be a novelty. So I don't know where to start here. So where did let's figure out, first of all, where you got involved with Stonehenge and in America and how it came about.
Well, yeah, my dad actually, Robert Stone, got involved with it back almost 65 years ago, back in 1955. He was a AT&T Western Electric Bell Laboratories engineer, you know, kind of into the tech stuff, but he was always very, very interested in the past. He was interested in Native Americans. He was interested in the Vikings coming to the Americas and that kind of thing. And he had just got out of the Coast Guard, and he started his new career with AT&T, who lasted there about 30 years. And he had a new family. I was about 1 year old. And he was listening to a radio show, just like we're doing right now, one of the biggest stations out of Boston, and it's still there today. And on a Friday night, they were talking about these strange stone ruins, which were located only about 8 miles from where he lived. And he, like you and Julie, he had never heard of this place. And, you know, he lived basically next door to it. And it was quite a surprise to hear this talk show. You know, it was probably a couple hours talking about these strange ruins, you know, and what they could be, who built them, why they were there. And it really kind of hooked my dad. And right after that, coincidentally, he was at a barbershop a couple days later looking at a magazine, waiting to have his hair cut. And as he opened it up and flipped through the pages, there was a whole article featured about the same site he just heard on the radio. So two things in 1 week about this site. That following weekend, he's at my aunt and uncle's. He actually took the magazine from the barbershop with the barber's permission. It was actually a three-year-old magazine. It had been in the barbershop for 3 years. It was 1952 when it came out. And they were getting together just to have a social evening, or probably playing cards, having some beer, you know, on a Saturday night. There were about 10 or 12 of them. And my dad actually took the magazine at one point, put it on the table in front of everybody, and passed it around. Anybody know what this place is or ever hear of it. And everybody kind of looked at it. Nobody knew what it was until it got to my aunt and uncle. And they looked at it, and all of a sudden it kind of like, oh, wow, we used to go there in the 1930s on our bicycles when my aunt and uncle were dating. They went down and they picnicked at this particular place. So it was kind of, you know, my dad was quite surprised. And that following Sunday, they got together, the four of them, my dad, mom, my aunt and uncle, they got in a car and they drove down trying to find a place. It was not open to the public. It was on a hill in the deep woods, and they drove around trying to find some sort of, you know, avenue or entrance to the place. And they finally found an old dirt road, and they went up on a site, and my dad spent some time, because there's a big chain link fence around the main part of the site, which is about 1 acre where most of the stone ruins, but it's about a 110-acre site altogether. So he walked, got underneath the fence. It was locked up at the time, and he spent quite a bit of time. And after he came out, the rest of them were standing outside waiting for him. I said, what do you think? And he goes, this place is amazing. So it was really my dad, you know, and he died about 9 years ago. And so it's always been in my family, and I'm the second generation, and I have a son named Kelsey. He's going to turn 30 next month, and he's an engineer like my dad, and he's kind of involved with it too. So it's kind of a family affair for about 65 years.
So do we know how old this area is, and what where it came from, like who built it or any of the real history like that?
Yeah, that's a great question, how old the site is. And the work on the site actually began in the 1930s, around the time my aunt and uncle first visited. And the work has been continuing for 8 years now, or actually going on its 82nd year of research. We've taken 12 radiocarbon datings of the site. We've also surveyed the what we call the astronomical alignments, and that's what makes it functionally similar to Stonehenge. The form is different when you look at it, but it has these big standing stones all around the outside, probably about 500 feet from the main site, and there's actually a center where all the alignments come together for solstices, equinoxes, cross-quarter days, lunar alignments, like Stonehenge, actually. And so the work on that began in 1967, but by 1977, we had done a couple years of survey using a professional surveyor, and that information was sent to the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the next year, the results came back, and they said, well, if those alignments were used for that purpose, to watch a sun or moon or star alignment, they don't quite work today, but they would work about 1800 BC. And one of the carbon datings, actually 1971, which is, I think, the fourth or fifth carbon dating we had taken on the site, actually dated part of the site back to about 4,000 years. So that was in 71, and by 1978, we get the results back astronomically that kind of agreed with that radiocarbon dating. So I think the site's about 2000 BC, about 4,000 years old. And Stonehenge in England, as Stu was saying, goes back at the beginning, I think, around 5,000 years, and it took about 1,500 years to build. And like Stonehenge, we think it's kind of a tomb, temple, and monument complex, not a place where people lived. It was more of a place where people probably worshipped, ceremonies were performed. It's on a big hill. And it's more like some of the other megalithic sites. There are about 50,000 of them in Western Europe, so Stonehenge being the most famous. But it's not the oldest nor the biggest, if you will. And they actually stretch into Russia, China, India, Korea, Australia. They're finding megalithic-type sites in Australia and South America. So they're on six continents, and we have about 800 of them in the Northeast. From Canada right through the mid-Atlantic states, over the last 80 years, they've detected, found, recorded, photographed, and done excavations on some of these, not all of them. But we think our site is just one of about 800. And when my dad got involved in 1955, I think they knew of about 12 of these sites in the Northeast. So they're actually all over the place. And ours may be the most known in America as being kind of a megalithic-type site. But it's still not well-known like Stonehenge in England, of course. I mean, it's just world-famous.
Yeah. Are there any other similarities, Dennis? Because over the many, many years, obviously with the interest in Stonehenge in Wiltshire in the UK, they found a reliable year-round spring, for example. So there's a water supply. They found that there's long barrow tombs in the surrounding landscape. So is there anything like that with your Stonehenge on the outskirts, the periphery of the stones themselves?
We do have some chambers that are very similar to some of the particular structures. Like, we have a structure called the V Hut. It looks like a V as a letter V as in Victor. And it's facing the southwest. It's the only structure on the site that's not orientated north, south, east, and west out of True North. And to the light, Polaris is over True North. 4,000 years ago, it was a star called Thuban. It looks very much like the wedge tombs I've seen in Ireland, and they all face southwest. And if you look at, I've been to Spain, but I didn't get a chance to see some of the megalithic ruins in Spain. They are pretty phenomenal there, too, in Portugal, too. But they have similar structures. They look like a wedge tomb. And I'm trying to still find out more about them to find the size and the orientation. But I'm like, that looks like a wedge tomb of Ireland, but it also looks like our V Hut. And next to our V Hut on the main site, there's a structure called the galley or gallery. Or we call it the east-west chamber, but it looks like a gallery or galley grid. In Holland, they call them the giant's bed. They're always orientated true east and west, again, out of true north, and they run 20 to 60 feet. And it looks like our east-west chamber, but they're in northwest Ireland. And I've been to Ireland, but I didn't get that part of Ireland, unfortunately. But I did see them in France near Carnac, which is pretty famous. And they had the same kind of structure with upright slabs and then stone roofs on top, just like our site has all these gigantic stones that create the roof. Kind of like the Flintstones house, if you will, but they're not houses. We think they're, you know, like I mentioned, tombs, temples, and monuments. But the orientation, the size, and the shape of some of the structures, not only at our site, but throughout the Northeast, look so much like what you see throughout the megalithic sites of Europe. You know, you can actually look at them and say, oh, that looks like this chamber. This, that looks like, they're so, the comparison's amazing, you know. So you have to look at the size, the shape, and the orientation of these structures. And they're either one heck of a coincidence or there's some sort of transatlantic, you know, crossing at some time in the past. And recently I just read a brand new thing. The theory is now that megalithic sites actually started in France and then they spread out by boat across the Mediterranean and also into Scandinavia and Germany and the British Isles from France. And that's, this came up on the web the other day. In the 1970s, a lot of people thought some of these megalithic sites were independent invention. People weren't in contact with one another. It was just a coincidence all across Europe. You know, a lot of these were just independently created without people in communication. That was in the 70s, maybe in the 80s. And now the latest was by a woman. I forget what her title is and where she's from. And her name, I just forgot that too. But that's, she's putting this, you know, this whole theory. She has like 2,400 carbon dating she's looked at. She had to speak, go in, talk to people in 11 different languages and get the translation because they're all over Europe. And it took years to put this together, but she thinks the fusion was going on, people going by boats, spreading this technology all around Europe, probably into Russia and further, you know. So so there is a similarity.
And what about the actual physical presentation? So Stonehenge here has like 30 enormous sarsen and stones, and they're in a kind of semicircle. Or a circle with the stones across the top. And is that a similar, for those people listening now who haven't got access immediately to your website to see pictures, what is it like there?
Yeah, the 30, I believe the sarsens, I guess it's 29 and a half, representing the 29 and a half days of the lunar month. You know, one of the uprights is actually a half-sized one, I guess. But that Stonehenge is so unique. You know, it's so unique among the megalithic sites of Europe. It's amazing. I mean, it has a henge, you know, the Banken dish, and had the the blue stones from Wales, and then the sarsen stones. But of the 50,000, it's real. There are circles. I mean, England and Wales have about 800, and Scotland has about 800 stone circles. But as you know, it's really amazing what Stonehenge looks like, especially with the lintel stones on top. Our site looks more like, I mentioned, other megalithic sites. We have a monolith, which is a single standing stone. The sun will rise over the top of that stone. Or set kind of like the heel stone at Stonehenge, but many of those, you know, surrounding the whole site, they look like large arrowheads. And they vary from about probably 6 feet up to about 10 feet in length. And one of them is actually 14 feet long. We call it a menhir or a long stone. That's what they use for a term in Europe, too, a menhir. But our site, you'd have to look at other sites, you know, to see the similarity. Stonehenge functionally is just like us. You know, it has a cross quarter, the quarter days, the lunar alignments. But the form of it's different than our site and other sites in Europe and as well as over here. Stonehenge, I think, is all by itself in its shape, really, you know. It's amazing.
So when you when you, so you say it was a place of probably worship or something, and you have a sacrificial table, and I know that picture got put up on our website. Maybe explain what do you think that's from? Like what do you mean by sacrificial table?
Well, we think it could be an altar stone. It could be for ceremonial purposes. Yeah, it's roughly 9 feet long and about 6 feet wide. It looks like a bell, kind of shaped like a big bell, if you will. We know the quarry site that it came out of. It's about 40 feet away. They actually picked up this 45, it's about a 9,000 pound stone, 4.5 tons, and they moved it about 40 feet. And then they set it up on four legs. And adjacent to that, that stone slab is the Oracle Chamber, which is the biggest structure still remaining on the site. It's just under 30 feet long. It runs true north and south. It has a branch that goes off to the east about just under 20 feet. If you look down at it and you could remove the roof, it would look like a Y, I guess, kind of a shape. But the sacrificial table, the groove on it, is actually roughly 4 by 6 feet, and it's trapezoid in shape. And we're finding a couple of the chamber floor plans are trapezoid in shape. We used to think that was a rectangular shape on the table, but we measured it. And it's about 9 inches shorter at the top than it is at the bottom. So it's significantly a trapezoid.
So now, were there bones and bodies found there or anything like that?
Well, in New England, the soil is very acidic. We have a problem with that. My dad was a member of the New Hampshire Archaeological Society, and I get all the publications, and the president of the group has actually done work on our site for 30 years. He's really well known in this whole region as a, you know, for her archaeological work. Between what I talked to her about this and also what I've read in the journals and everything, they have found a few pieces of bones in New Hampshire, for instance, going back over a couple thousand years, but it's very rare because the soil is very acidic. It eats up the bones, and usually 200 or 300 years, the bones are gone. Occasionally you'll find bones in either peat or maybe like clay or some other material that kind of preserves them, but you can pretty much count most of the bones will dissolve. When the work began on our site in 1930s, the gentleman that worked on it used the best techniques they had available at the time, but they would get in and they would dig, they would sift, they would look for artifacts you could hold in your hand. Today that soil that came out of those structures is as important as any artifact that would come out of the chambers. Because they would take that soil, send it to a laboratory, and they could do the chemical analysis on it. And this might yield information saying, yes, this was a burial. We have the chemical traces of, you know, like a human burial here or something like that. But over 80 years ago, that soil was cleaned out. We got pictures before, going back to 1920, 15 years, 16 years before the archaeology began. People were up there taking pictures, fortunately. You can see there's dirt in the structures. And then when this gentleman, Mr. Goodwin, got there in 1936, began excavating in 1937. He died in 1950. So in between those years, you were doing excavation and some repair work on the site, you know, and diagramming the site and all of that. The dirt's missing today. It was just taken, sifted, and it's off to the side now, which is a shame, you know. But that's the problem with archaeology. When you dig a hole, you disturb it pretty much forever. So today they usually leave an area untouched for future archaeologists, but that methodology wasn't there, you know, over 80 years ago. So they did find a couple bones on the site, though, and one of them was sent to a museum. They looked at it in 1970, and they said it looked like it was human. They didn't carbon date it, and to be honest with you, I've looked for that fragment in some of our files, and I haven't been able to locate it yet. It still may be there. But I'm not sure it's even with us because it was sent away. I'm not sure if it ever came back in 1970. I'm still looking for some information that might, you know, tell us that, you know, which would be interesting. They can do a lot more with DNA and all this stuff today. So
now I was going to ask you about the astronomical alignments as well. Like, were the stones set up in a particular way that you can tell?
Yeah, even 80 years ago, Mr. Goodwin and other people up there knew way out in the woods and was all covered with the forest that there were these upright stones. Kind of a mystery. Why would anybody build all these thousands of feet of stones and then have all these arrowhead stones way out in the middle of the woods? And so the work on that began in 1967. And the reason for that is there was a book called Stonehenge Dakota by Gerald Hopkins. And he was with the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and I think Boston College. And he wrote that book in 65. And CBS did a special about Stonehenge called, I think, The Mysteries of Stonehenge. So that really, you know, really got the interest among our researchers and my dad including, that maybe some of these stones out there had a meaning. Why would somebody go out there and quarry these big pieces of stone off the bedrock? And they've been shaped like an arrowhead, which is now today we know that they were shaped or dressed using a technique called percussion flaking. It's stone against stone to shape them. And why would they go to all that trouble and stand them up on the walls? Farmers in New England started building walls in the 1700s to clear fields of rock, usually tumbled, rounded-type rocks, not big slabs necessarily. There are a few that glaciers would pull out of the bedrock, but generally rounded kind of rocks and big glacial boulders. But our walls contain all these slabs of stone, and these slabs were actually intentionally removed from the bedrock and then positioned into the wall as some of these sanding stones today we know as the astronomical marker stones. And yeah, there is a pattern. There's about 26 alignments that we have at the site. And they don't quite work today except for the equinoxes due to the Earth's tilt. The Earth's tilt is about 23 degrees, 26 minutes. It changes about 1 minute, 1/60th of a degree every century. And Sir Norman Lockyer, back I think 100 years ago in England, he saw this and he said, I wonder if there's a way that we can actually date these sites because it seems to be an era where the sun sets over these alignments. It's off a little bit today. And he said, I think we could probably figure out how old these sites are, you know, if we can determine when they worked, when these alignments worked, you know, and what the rate of tilt change was. They called it obliquity. So he was on that 100 years ago. And today with all the computers and everything, you know, I mean, you could probably do it on your smartphone. There are all these different types of apps. I can actually use one of them and go back 20-something thousand years, and I can see what the sunrise and sunset looked like in the past, what the signs of the zodiac are as the Earth, the precession, which is 26,000-year cycle versus the 41,000 obliquity cycle. These two cycles are going on very slowly over time. So any ancient site will be off a little bit for the solstices and for the lunar alignments, but the equinox, it still works. So it's a great way of dating a site, I think. You know, it will back up carbon dating and other techniques they use, too.
So was there a lot of folk tales or old tales about that area or old stories that we know about now?
There are a few, yeah. The History of Salem was written in 1907, and the guy was a friend of Robert Frost, actually, and his name was Edgar Gilbert. The book came out in 1907, and our site is in that. And he said that about 70 years ago, Paddy family lived up there, and some of the stone chambers still exist today, and it's a weird but wild and wonderful place where fantastic tales can be woven among the soft pine and the rough boulders. But we also heard stories that Native Americans tended to shy away from the place. They thought these kind of sites were taboo, kind of a place they didn't want to go to. That's one of the things I've heard over the years, you know. And then a woman named Paula Runda, which she lived in California, but she was Iroquois, and she had to learn 10,000 years of her family's oral tradition. Her grandfather taught her this, and she had to repeat it back a couple of different ways so she had the story straight for all those, you know, thousands of years. And in the oral tradition, she said they talk about, and she's in California. She never lived in the northeast part where the Iroquois would have been the Great Lakes and part of New York, that area. And actually visiting into the New England area, the ancient tribes would. But they talked about these hills with these stone ruins and that it was a strange people that built them, but not her Iroquois, you know, relatives or ancestors. And living in California, never heard of our place before or some of the other stone ruins in New England. She finally became aware in the 1990s of these, possibly from a TV show or maybe the internet, you know. And she got, oh my gosh, this actually makes sense. So she has a book that's about 3 inches thick called The Walking People, and it's got the 10,000 years of tradition. And again, it's kind of mentioned in there, you know, that it was a different people, not her people. It was kind of a strange people that built these stone ruins, you know, in the Northeast. So it's one of those tales, you know, or stories. And oral tradition can be, you know, pretty accurate. You know, they take it as history, actually, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It comes from something. It comes from a truth.
Yeah.
You know?
Something, yeah. Right.
Well, so I was just wondering, now, I know it's not your strong point, you were saying, but So there is a paranormal connection to the Stonehenge as well, or is it just kind of is that more just folklore?
Well, there are, you know, we've had people visit our site over the years. I don't know if you're familiar with Hans Holzer. He was a gentleman that wrote, like, Ghost I've Met. He has passed away, but he had been on TV shows like Good Morning America, you know. But Hans Holzer visited us first time in 1971. In 1974, he brought up four different psychics separately that didn't know each other. And he wrote a book in 1992, about 20 years after that event. And I was just reading it again this year because I hadn't seen it for years. And the four different psychics, the names of the people, and what they felt up at the site. And one of the things they're trying to discover, you know, who were the people that built the site, how old the site was, what was it used for, you know. And they all came out with similar kind of, responses, I guess, or what they sensed, you know, was similar. It was kind of interesting, you know, what they said was very similar, even though they didn't talk. And they came up four different different times in the year to visit our site. And Hans Holzer came back in 1974 with those psychics. And then 2 years.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day. But some days, you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Later he came back and he actually had written the script for Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of. I think we were number two on the 144 episodes. And I think he gets a little bit into the psychic on that show too. He interviews my dad, my uncle Oz, and a number of other researchers from a group called New England Antiquities Research Association. So I think I'd have to look at that video again because I think he mentions a little bit about the paranormal in that. We have had paranormal, in the fall, usually in October, we had paranormal groups come up to our site. And I'm, as I mentioned, I just retired from the airlines after 35 years. My best schedules that I could bid each month were usually working Friday through Mondays. I got the best schedules. So I usually missed all the Saturday night, what we call ghost walks or paranormal events. So I wasn't there for almost every one of them I missed, unfortunately. But I'm retired now, so maybe that will change a little bit. So we have had thousands at our site, too. We had Francis Hitching and John Mitchell. And they're from England, I think, both of them. And they were at our place in 1978. And they wrote about the site and how they doused the water lines. And our stone, some of our stone walls actually overlay the water lines. And then the ley lines are the astronomical alignments. And 6 years ago, my son Kelsey was looking at Google Earth and just going out to where some of the other New England sites to see if they were on a line, you know, on the same line as some of the solstices or equinox alignments. And one of them, the summer solstice sunrise, which is a beautiful stone, it's shaped actually to fit the horizon. About 5 miles away, there's two hills that come together in a notch, and the stone actually was shaped to fit into that notch. It kind of fits right into it. So if you're watching the sunrise, you'll see the stone and the horizon, and the sun will rise 90 degrees to that little notch on the top of the rock and the horizon 5 miles away. Well, he followed that line right across New England, and across Nova Scotia, right across. And then he said, well, I'll just go across the ocean and see where it comes out. And it came out in southern England. And we've been to Stonehenge. Well, he's been there a couple times. I've been there probably half a dozen times. And he said, geez, this looks kind of familiar. It looks like it's in the Stonehenge area. So he changed the scale, and as he blew it up, eventually Stonehenge appears on Google Earth. And there it is. And the line goes right through under the large trilithons, right through the center of it. And, you know, anybody can try it. But it's not Google Maps, Google Earth. And so that when you're watching the summer solstice sunrise at our site, if you had Superman vision or something and could see around the world on that straight line, it would actually go right through the center of Stonehenge. Some of the other astronomical alignments are like the winter solstice sunset goes to the moon pyramid at Teotihuacan, which I visited with my dad back in the 80s. The equinox sunset goes through Chaco Canyon, which is an amazing ancient site in New Mexico. That's an amazing site. It's a National Historic Monument. The equinox sunrise goes to the Canary Island pyramids, and I'm trying to think of the other one. Oh, our true south alignment goes to Machu Picchu in South America, in Peru. So there are these lines from our site that do go to other very important ancient sites, usually the UNESCO World Heritage sites, basically, you know, like Stonehenge. So that's something that's kind of hard to explain. It could be a coincidence. We have to kind of consider that. But they're right on the money, too. You know, it's like, wow. You know, it's kind of, some people believe in sacred geometry and energy points of the world, and like Stonehenge would be on, pyramids in Egypt, that kind of thing. So they have drawn maps of the world, and sometimes where our site is included in it, of a kind of a intersection of many of these points coming together.
I think it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, it's just how so many places connected actually by those lines, and whilst I think many people, so an example would be people who are going out and they're doing, for want of a better phrase, ghost hunting, they will often refer to ley lines without really understanding the history behind that and how so many different places link. And of course in your area in Salem, that's known for it's kind of paranormal. And many of these archaeological sites also have sites, local to them. Mm. One thing is that, England is very well known for, and I'm sure you're very aware of this, is its folklore and the legends of King Arthur. And that's also linked to Stonehenge. And we know I think it was Al and I actually, wasn't it Al, who interviewed a gentleman on the myths of King Arthur, which was a fascinating interview. So we know that actually Stonehenge itself will have not been attributed to the king himself, but he still contributes to the folklore around it. And it's just so amazing how these monuments, they are there through history, and the stories just continue to grow around them, and just hope really that one day we don't lose track of all of those stories as time evolves.
Some of those stories are beautiful the way they tell them too, you know. I think with Merlin and Stonehenge and all of that, it's so neat when you read them, you know. It kind of chills you back a little bit, you know. and there's more to learn about our site, obviously, about some of the past. Unfortunately, a lot of the, you know, a lot of the Native Americans, because of diseases and such, you know, died in the area, you know, after the, you know, the colonization, you know. So some of those tales are probably, we can still discover some of that, you know, some of the myths and legends of these sites, you know. But I think that Paula Runderwin one is one that's pretty good, you know. But yeah, the ley lines and all of that. And I actually have a 1927 book by Alfred Watkins, you know, and I believe it was printed in London or something. And it's one of the original copies. The Old Straight Track, I think, was the name of the book, you know. So it was my dad's collection. I'm like, oh, that's kind of neat. I didn't know he had that, you know. So going through my dad's, I'm still going through all my dad's, you know, almost 60 years worth of research, all his books and everything. I'm discovering some really cool stuff, including one book from 1835, because the family that was up there were actually part of the abolitionist movement, helping the slaves move up to Canada. And he actually, just before he, Jonathan Patty, he was a shoemaker, you know, fifth-generation shoemaker, and his great-great-grandfather came from England. But before that, he was involved with the taking in the town paupers, the poor people, and we have actually the actual written town records, and it's an original copy, all handwritten, and he got paid, and many, many people in Salem did this to help out the poor, and they got paid, actually, by the time to do this, and I actually got from 1831 to 1836 when he took in some of the town poor people. And by 1837, that was the last year he did it. And I think that's when he began taking in the slaves as part of the Underground Railway as they were trying to escape again out of the South, heading up towards Canada to freedom, you know. So our site has a lot of history, too. So it's historical and prehistorical, too.
And you never stop learning, do you? I mean, the Stonehenge Hidden Gate Project here, continually finding new associations with Stonehenge and similar sites, and a round barrow in has been in 2010, and they continue to develop it. And of course, with that comes a lot of protection as well, because as you rightly said earlier, as soon as you open something up, that's it. It's there, it's open to the elements, it's open to damage. How do you protect your site?
Yeah, I mean, we do the best we can. You know, it was uncovered during the 1930s, and some preventative maintenance has gone on over the years, you know, not only to protect the structures, but also the visitors, you know. So it's an ongoing process on the site. Some of the stones sometimes come loose. We have a couple of guys. Unfortunately, one of our gentlemen, Dr. David Stewart Smith, he was with us from 1978. He just passed away 2 years ago, and he was a real resource and asset to our place. He's the one that really did a lot of work, the way the stones were quarried, shaped, transported, you know, and he actually wrote that up. He published that, and he even had the state, New Hampshire state archaeologist, who was also a doctor of anthropology and archaeology, verify a lot of his work, you know. But Dave had spent 6 years prior to that working for the British government, doing repair work on medieval structures and megalithic sites in Europe, you know, some of the, not all the 50,000, but quite a few of them. And he would pick out pictures and say, oh, yeah, I worked in that chamber and I worked in that chamber. So he had a really nice understanding and a lot of experience on both sides of the ocean. So, and like I say, 2 years ago we lost him. And since he has passed, we have found more features. We're finding some of our walls, some of the thousands of feet of walls, are actually serpentine in shape. It's shaped like a serpent with a head, a body, and then a tail. And we're not the only site. We're finding the same thing in Connecticut. There's one town with over 8,000 features. We think they're prehistoric. There's chambers very similar to our site, standing stones, cairns, dolmens, which are big rocks with legs. And, you know, dolmens in England and in Ireland are all over the place over there. And also serpentine walls. And that one town has over 400 serpentine walls. And you look at them, like at pictures of them, they're like, oh, my God, that is a serpent. It's got a serpent head. Sometimes it's a glacial boulder, and they actually touched it up with like an eye and a nose. But it's the wall behind it, the undulating wall that goes up and down and runs either 30 feet, in some cases up to 300 feet, and has a tail. Some of the walls get fat, like maybe a serpent ate its prey. And some of them are linear or straight. Some are rectilinear, like a snake, you know, with its head bent or its tail bent. And some are curved, beautiful shaped curves. And our site has about 12 of these. And again, they run about 30 feet. And our longest one goes 2,500 feet and circles the main site. I mentioned that's about a 1 acre area. But this is actually outside of that. And it would contain about 15 acres or maybe close to 20 acres. and it's a serpent with a gigantic glacial boulder head. The wall undulates behind it up and down, and then it goes around, and it touches every astronomical sunrise, sunset, or star monolith. It touches every one of them, and it comes back in front of itself, and then it looks like it does one more hump, and it looks like the serpent biting its tail, which is called the Ouroboros. And the Greek, Egyptian, you know, mythology represents eternity, that symbol of the snake biting its tail. But it seems to be a worldwide thing, too. You probably heard of that, you know. It's kind of neat.
Fascinating, isn't it? I mean, the you could go anywhere with this subject. I was just, when we first came up, I was talking about how our Stonehenge is now roped off to avoid people going in and touching the stones. Because of, well, just overuse and vandalism and wearing them away. And they that went before the Court of Human Rights because obviously it's an ancient site of worship. So the Court of Human Rights said, well, actually, anybody who's got a genuine religion has the right to worship in their own place. So therefore, with neo-Druids, pagans and other earth-based or old religions, they should be able to worship at the summer solstice or the winter solstice. And I was just reading a fact that over 30,000 people attended the gathering at the stones at the summer solstice in 2003.
Wow.
30,000 people.
That's about what we did during the course of a year, so we don't have the wear and tear quite as Stonehenge, you know. You get a million people there a year. It does, so it's kind of a balance, I guess, you know, letting people get in or protecting the site. I guess it's kind of one of those balancing things, you know. And so far at our site, the stone is granite, very, very hard, and we have signs up, please don't touch anything, respect the site, leave only, you know, don't take anything but memories with you or photographs, you know. People like to take stuff, you know. That's what happened at Stonehenge. You know, people are chipping away the stones, as you mentioned. We don't want that. You know, leave it alone. Don't touch it. Look at it. Respect it. So people can walk among our ruins. You know, we have a couple little areas because it might be a little dangerous because of a roof slab caved into one chamber, things like that, that we keep the public away from, you know, and we don't want them on the chambers either because that does cause wear, you know, tear. Somebody can injure themselves too. But, yeah, so we're open for the solstices, you know. We stay open morning and evening for those so people can come up there and get a real experience, you know, of the whole thing. And that's our popular days. I think the most we had for one of our solstices was just over 1,000 people. So not too bad, you know, for a place that's not too well known.
And what happens at something like that? Because, you know, obviously when you have an ancient place that is attractive to people, quite often people turn them into attractions. So here in North Wales, we've got Arthur's Labyrinth, for example, where you go underground and you explore the chambers that King Arthur allegedly laid in and was put to rest in. So do you see anything like that happening with your Stonehenge? Do you cater for as an entertainment at any point in the year?
I'm not sure of the question. Could you say that a different way, maybe?
So do you, that's one thing I'm very good at, Dennis, is waffling. Okay, when I ask you
questions. Oh, no problem. I wasn't sure which angle you were going at. So, yeah, if you could, yeah.
I guess it's about, do you adapt it being a raw historic site to cater for people who want more of an entertainment? So to put on, is it literally up, are there events there? Is something more entertaining rather than just people being able to go?
I think, yeah, we have, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question correctly. We do have weddings that take up place up there, but it's kind of low key. The people really like the site, you know, they respect it. And the weddings, you know, I think the biggest one we had was between 50 and 100 people up there. So we do a few weddings, you know, and they, and it's very respectful. We do have the celebrations for the solstices and equinoxes. We have occasionally people come up there and, you know, they'll have their birthdays or things like that at our site and they'll have a little party. But we don't illuminate the site like some of the places. I know, we've been to the Parthenon and, I think, Chichen Itza, the temple there, they light it up, although it looked pretty spectacular for a light show. You know, it's a nighttime event that, and I haven't been there for about 20 years in Mexico, but there's a couple other places like that around the world. Maybe the Sphinx does that too, where they illuminate it at night with different colors and lasers and stuff like that. We haven't done anything like that. But we do host different events up there, and we do snowshoeing in the winter. We open up all the trails around the entire hilltop, and we do have snow right now, and the snowshoe trails are open, and it's a beautiful walk through the woods in snowshoes. You know, we go down by the glacial cliff shelter where we did find pottery that dates back about 2,500 years. It's Native American Middle Woodland period. And that's the only time of the year we let people go out there, because we don't want people climbing up in there causing damage, as you mentioned, you know, and people's curiosity get the better of them. And there is probably still more pottery out there, you know. In the wintertime, it's covered with a blanket of snow, and it protects it. You know, it's frozen, you know, which is good. But in the summer, they could get up there, and they could hurt themselves because it's very steep, and they could take artifacts away. A few years ago, we got a bag in the mail, and people had been on that excavation in 1959. That's one of the excavations my dad worked on. And they sent us back pieces of pottery that they had pocketed, and they kept for like 55 years. And they finally felt guilty, and they sent it back to us in the mail. So that was good. That's a good thing, you know, that that can happen.
So, I mean, you must be incredibly proud of this, I suppose, legacy in many ways that your dad began for your family to be involved in
this
historic site. What's next for you guys as a family? How do you see this progressing? How do you see your protection of the site going forward?
Well, we're going to be doing a forest management survey to the whole hilltop. That lady that was the archaeologist, and she's still with us. In the 90s, she spent 6 years and she mapped the hilltop geologically. And her husband was a doctor of geology at Tufts University in Boston, so he was a doctor of geology. What she says is the hilltop was pretty bare 4,000 years ago. 25% glacial soil and soils. The other part of it was pretty much bare bedrock. And that made it easy for the quarry crews in the ancient times. Hey, we need some rock slabs. Can you go out and find areas where we can lift up the bedrock? And so they could go out there, and today they'd have a devil of a time because it's covered with trees and forest, and except where we cleared out the avenues to witness, you know, the solstices and equinoxes, which are hundreds and hundreds of feet of tree clearing. The other thing is we have a whole network of underground drains covering the main site. Some of the drains are up to 75 feet. They're parallel walls with little capstones, and they're just like a storm drain in the city, you know, and the water goes through a cutout in the bedrock, and then it'll channel into this underground drains, and there's about 12, biggest one's about 75 feet long. And we said, why would they go to all this trouble? And they did it before they built all the chambers around. You know, it was one of the first things they engineered because the structures are built above drain. Well, it's probably because the hilltop, again, was bare, and the site was pretty bare. So when it rained and when snow melted, it would puddle up. So they had a whole system of channeling the water away. When the Paddies lived there for a while, there was still plenty of dirt. It would absorb the rainwater. The other thing, without trees on top of the hill, except for a small amount of them, you could see all the alignments of the sun rising and setting. Today we have a forest problem, but at Stonehenge today when you go out there, it's pretty open. You know, you have a few trees in England on the Salisbury Plain. But I understand 5,000 years ago you had a forest there. So you had a forest problem, and they used up a lot of the forest. We had the opposite.
Wow.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I don't know what happened there. She must have got cut.
Oh, I know. She was saying something. I know. She cut out a couple times. We are going to be using modern technology. There's a thing called optically stimulated luminescence, and you can actually date dirt. You get a core next to one of our stone chambers, like a wall down low, or you get dirt next to one of our thousands of feet of walls. Maybe we can do multiple tests. And you send it to a laboratory, this core, and you get it down deep. And they can tell you how long that dirt has been sitting next to the wall. So you build a wall on bedrock, and then very slowly soil accumulates. Right now it's about an inch every 100 years in New England. In the past it was a slower rate because we didn't have the vegetation, you know, falling on the dirt as much, you know, rotting. And the windblown soil has always been there. So we're going to try to do that. It's very expensive. It's over $1,000 per core, and you have to have some baseline cores around it. One chamber they did in Massachusetts, everybody said it's 200, 300 years old, the mainstream, historical, archaeological people. Well, the minimum date on it came out. They did the test 2011. They got the results back just a couple of years ago. University of Colorado, I think, in Denver did it, if I am not mistaken. And it was a woman that did the whole thing. And it was very, very, very complicated what they do. But anyway, the date came back on this chamber about 1480 A.D., and that's not when the chamber was built. It's when it was already sitting there. So the chamber may have been there not 200 years ago, but over 600 years ago. It's one of these chambers that looks like a beehive. It looks like a passageway in England or other European sites, like an igloo shape. And it's aligned with the Pleiades and a solstice, actually, the avenue where you walk into it. Like I said, it's got a long tunnel. So there's an element called surface luminescence, and you can actually date a structure without doing any invasive thing like putting a hole in the ground, and you can get a direct date on the structure. So this is even something even better. And if we can afford it and find the people that can do this kind of dating, we can start to date some of the stone walls and some of the chambers where they haven't been disturbed by anybody. And again, it's called surface luminescence, and it's something brand new. And we are also doing thermal imaging with drones and aircraft of our site. Eventually, we're going to have a 1 square mile 3D image of the site using high-definition color cameras and a thermal imaging camera. We have a gentleman that moved in from the West Coast, and he's been doing this part-time for us. So, and you can actually see things about 14 inches into the ground. So if something's hiding, you know, it might actually show up on the images. And when you walk on the ground, you won't see anything, but on the images, be something there. We could do a shovel test pit and test it to see if there's, in fact, something below the surface that should be looked at.
Just
wow,
amazing.
That's really...
Yeah. Now let's talk about your communications now. So you've got everything from an app to a website to Facebook. How about letting the listeners know how to get a hold of you?
Oh, sure, yeah. We have a website, stonehengeusa.com. And it has a few photographs. It has calendar events like the solstices and equinoxes. And it has an email address in there. So if they want to contact us, info@StonehengeUSA, it's there. And also we have a Facebook page, and we do Instagram. I let my daughter-in-law handle a lot of that. But I think we have close to 10,000, I think, Facebook followers. And, you know, so we keep up on these. We put things in there like other... We have a site down the road, we think, that looks similar to our site, about 6 miles away. We got some photographs. It totally took us by surprise about a week and a half ago. Now we've got to get landowner permission to go over there, take some photographs, look at it. But the images we got back from my son, it's my son's friend that actually got the pictures. I'm like, oh, my God, that looks just like us. You know, it has chambers like us and some sculptured stones, standing stones, and other features. So something like that would go into our Facebook and webpage. If there's some new discovery, you know, we'll put it up there, too. So StonehengeUSA.com is our web. And so if they have any questions, there's a phone number there, too, and they can even give us a call if they want to talk to us.
And what about your new app?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's under America's Stonehenge, and it's an app. And it has pictures, it has audio, and it has text. So you can actually use it at our site on the tour. And we have a 4-page tour guide map that we've been using since the 1960s, although we updated it. We got to do a little more update because we found some serpentine walls and windows. But that app is excellent. And you can use that at home, too, like after the show, if you want to check out what the place looks like. You can go into America Stonehenge, Android or Apple, you'll see our symbol come up. It's a sun setting over a stone. And just click onto that, and it will take just a few seconds to download. And then you can do a tour of our site, basically.
Wow. Well, Dennis, it's been a fascinating hour. Our guest has been Dennis Stone, and we've been talking about the Stonehenge USA. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate both of you, and if we ever have anything new, we'll let you know. And we can talk about some of the new discoveries coming up, for sure.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.